First of all, I'd like to welcome you all to today's event. I probably don't need to introduce our teacher Long Po very much. Some of you maybe don't know him. Long Po, as a senior Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, has been instrumental, I think, in establishing Dhammapala Monastery in Switzerland, as well as several other monasteries in Europe. And now, for a few years, a few years ago, he returned to Thailand, where he started his monastic career, living in Wat Ratanavan, Ajahn Yanadamo's monastery in the province of Korat. At the moment, though, he is traveling together with his attendant and secretary, Ajahn Asoko, who is sitting on his left, to the United States and Canada to visit a couple of the most recently established monasteries of our particular Sangha, of our group, which is Tisarana Monastery in Canada, monastery where Ajahn Veeradamo is the abbot now. Some of you will remember him. I think Ajahn Veeradamo was perhaps the first, or certainly one of the first monks who came together with Long Po Sumedho to Switzerland to teach, before Dhammapala was established in Switzerland, first in a place, in a different place actually, in a small village or small town, Kongelfingen, near Bern. Before going there, though, he will first go to Temple Monastery near Boston, where Ajahn Jayanto is now the abbot, also recently established. And Ajahn Jayanto, in fact, most of you won't know, he was one of the very first Anagarikas here in Kongelfingen. And at least one story, which he tells me, is that Ajahn Jayanto was actually the monk who, as an Anagarika, found this place on an outing with Ajahn Veeradamo. And I think he was one of the first to try to persuade Ajahn Veeradamo to actually inquire whether this was actually possible to buy and turn into the monastery. So an interesting connection for these travels. And most fortunate for us, Ajahn Long Po Sumedho also agreed to make a stopover here in Switzerland on his travels, spending 3 weeks in Switzerland. He spent a week with the family of Ajahn Asoko, who is, I think we can call you Swiss-American, Swiss-American passport. He was born in America, same as Long Po, but his family is actually living in Geneva. And then now he is staying for 2 weeks with us, which we are very happy about, very much enjoying his visit. And also today he offered to give a Dhamma talk and perhaps also answer a few questions afterwards. And if that is enough of an introduction, then I would like to ask Kunjari to do the formal invitation for the Dhamma talk.
Namo dasa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo dasa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Brahma jaloka tipati sampati kat anchali antivarang ayajata santita sattapa parak chakachatika te se tu thammang anukampimang pachang.
I was just reminded to also remind you to please really pay attention to the talk. Switch off your mobile phones, please. Don't spend your time trying to make photographs or recordings of the wonderful occasion, but really pay attention to the Dhamma talk, out of respect to the teaching. If I press all the right buttons, then this talk is going to be recorded and it will soon appear on our website if you want to.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhuttang dhammang sanghang namassami. Thank you for the introduction, Ranjan. And I've just had a very peaceful week, over a week here in Dhammapala, looking at the cows. They're very peaceful animals. And there's a very beautiful valley kind of thing. And so the interest today seems to be growing everywhere in mindfulness practices. And so this is, that's quite a, you know, I came to live in England in 1977. And then, we lived in London 2 years, and hardly anybody showed any interest in mindfulness. They all wanted meditation, but samadhi practices, and they, even though the word mindfulness is a common enough English word, it didn't seem to have the significance that it has now. So what do we mean by that? I mean, it's, well, you know, we are mindful all the time, whether we know it or not. So, you know, if we weren't mindful, you would have died a long time ago. And we have to be mindful when we drive cars, when we prepare food, when we wash the dishes, when we cross the street. You know what you're doing. But then mindfulness, as it's used now, is a word for meditation. What do we mean by meditation? Because that is another English word that has generic qualities and covers all kinds of mental practices. And mindfulness meditation, instead of, you know, ordinarily we are going out to objects through the senses. So what we see, the objects of sight, the sound, the objects of the ear, and so forth, are what we tend to regard as the real world. We see the world as separate from ourselves. We see ourselves very much contained within the human form that we identify with, and we assume that our consciousness is within the form, contained within the form of each individual. And that's the worldly view of life. The materialistic view of life is based on that illusion of separateness, a self that is aligned with the physical form, with a changing condition. Because when you contemplate your physical body, you realize it's a form in nature. It was born, it grows up, gets old, and dies. And there's no way you can stop that process. Now, some people are trying not to die or grow old, but This is the nature of sankharas, of conditions or of phenomena. So our personal identity, how we see ourselves through the ego, the sense of an isolated form and the world is an object. And so that, of course, is a rather frightening scenario when you contemplate it, because as an individual form, the physical body is rather fragile, easily damaged, and, you know, so there's so many threatening possibilities of harm, of sickness, of death, of loss in our lives as human individuals. So there's one of the most common primal emotions we have is fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of what might happen in the future, anxiety, worry about the future. What will happen to Switzerland in 50 years of climate change? All possibilities of, you know, rather depressing possibilities in the future. But when we talk about mindfulness, it's here and now, you know, right now. If I should ask any one of you, all of you, whether you're conscious or not, you have to say yes. And one of you have, that's the obvious answer. You don't have to think about it, because you know at this moment you're conscious. So that's apparent here and now. That's the way it is. You know, if you can't find consciousness as an object, you know, if you try to look at it or listen to it or smell it, taste it, touch it, try to define consciousness that you're experiencing here and now, you can't do it. Because you are that. You're the consciousness here and now. And then consciousness is not contained and caged into a physical form. Consciousness has no form. It's one of the immeasurables. So consciousness has no form. So the consciousness that we're all experiencing here and now is one consciousness, not many consciousnesses operating. Now, this isn't dogma or doctrine, it's just ways of reflecting, changing from the accustomed way of seeing yourself as a totally separate, isolated physical being into changing into the sense of connection through consciousness with nature, with the world around us, with other human beings, with the created world that we're living in. So this is, in Buddhism, like Buddha Dhamma, consciousness has no dimensions, because even at this moment when you try to find it, you can't find it as an object, but you know it. And that very knowing is consciousness. But the delusion we have is that you are the physical body. Now you believe that that is your fate, your destiny, your way of living is confined and limited to a mortal form, where consciousness itself has no mortal form. It's unconditioned, it's not a mortal condition, it's not a sankhara, not a phenomenon. So when the Buddha was talking about sankharas, this is the Pali word for conditions or phenomena, things that arise and cease. We can be aware, you know, when the objects of the sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought are all sankharas. But instead of going outward, looking at things or listening to sounds, sending our conscious reality here now, always going out into the objects of consciousness, we turn it inward. So we begin to notice, observe the physical body as experience here and now. For example, we're aware that we're sitting, the physical body that each one of us aligns oneself to is in the sitting posture. There's some people standing, but their postures are sitting, standing, walking, lying down. There's four postures that every one of us use during the day and night. And we're aware of the body as an object sitting. It's like this, you know, so that's the body is in consciousness rather than consciousness is in the body. Or the breath. Every one of us is breathing in, breathing out. We're aware of the breath. We're aware of the temperature, whether you're hot or cold or just right. You know when it gets too hot or too cold through the physical form. You're aware of the state of mind that you're experiencing at this time, the mood, the emotional quality that is very individual, or what you're thinking. You're aware of the thinking that might be happening in you, or the feeling of pleasure, pain, heat and cold, or the emotion of love, hate, fear, greed, worry, anxiety, confusion. So in Vipassana meditation or insight meditation, we're turning our attention no longer outwardly into objects of sense which we like or dislike or love or hate, to the actual reality of what we're experiencing, of love is like this, hate is like this, confusion is like this, worry, anxiety is like this. And you know, don't you, what you're feeling at this moment. Maybe you can't explain it, because words are very inadequate to describe experience. But you know what you're feeling at this moment, even if it's doubt, confusion, agreement, disagreement, interest or boredom, it's like this. So in terms of in Buddhism we have the word Dhamma, or ultimate reality, or just plain reality. And so that's here and now. It's not about 50 years from now, what will Switzerland be like, or possibilities of landing on Mars, or the climate changing and making everything impossible. That's worrying about the future. That's possibility. That's probability. But it's still a mental state that arises, because the future isn't here and now. The future is tomorrow, next month. And these are concepts and perceptions that we create in the present. The future is unknown, isn't it? Tomorrow, you think you're making plans for tomorrow. You know, it's probably going to happen. It might not. Something might change. It's all possibility. Probability, maybe, could be, might happen. But these states of mind, just to clarify, the future at this moment, each one of us is not certain. You don't know, you have no memory of the future. So this is like reflecting on the way things are in the present moment. Then we think of yesterday. What yesterday, at this moment here and now, when we're sitting here in the shrine room, yesterday is what you remember. You can remember yesterday, you can't remember the future. But remembering yesterday and planning for the future are all happening here and now. So in mindfulness meditation, we're actually looking at this and seriously contemplating the way it is. And the way it is explained very eloquently by the Lord Buddha when he said, all conditions are impermanent. So what is impermanent at this point here and now? Is the body is impermanent? Seeing, perceiving, sensing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, memory, all emotional states arise and cease. But what doesn't arise and cease right now? What is aware of the arising and ceasing of conditions, of phenomena right now, is mindfulness, awareness, consciousness. So that is not a condition that comes and goes. So we call it the Amata Dhamma, or the deathless reality Dhamma. So in meditation, we're actually sorting this out, beginning to see the delusions we create about ourselves, about the world we live in. Once we see that, we let go. We no longer need to grasp certainties on the conditioned level, or hope for the best or fear the future or regret the past. Because consciousness is always here and now. Wherever you are, whatever is happening to you, in physically or mentally, emotionally, it's always here and now. So Dhamma is always here and now. It's not something remote or abstract or something that you have to believe in. And that's, you know, like believing itself is a condition of the mind. And many of us became Buddhists because we found it impossible to believe in metaphysical dogmas, doctrines created by other religions. If you've got a skeptical nature, a doubting mind, you know, people still to this day, there's arguments about, is there a God or not a God? Is there an afterlife? Is there, or even Buddhists, the reincarnation or rebirth? We're always speculating about the future. What happens when somebody dies? Is there heaven? Is there hell? Is there a God, or is atheism the answer to everything? So when we think, we create doubt. And the thinking process is very limited. It's a sankhara, it's a condition, it's a phenomenon that can be useful. It's not to be despised. But to be attached to thoughts, to views, to dogmas, to doctrines, to opinions, binds us to sankharas. They might be very good conditions. Sankharas have different qualities. But still, that blind attachment, that binding ourselves to mortal forms, to changing conditions, is the cause of suffering. So after the Buddha was enlightened, according to the scriptures, his first sermon to his five colleagues is called the Four Noble Truths. And this is quite interesting, at least I found this very interesting, because the Four Noble Truths is a very different take in terms of religious teaching. Instead of pointing to you must believe in Buddha or Dhamma or in some deity or something, you know, higher state, he pointed to the most common experience of all humanity, suffering. It's the, you know, that suffering is the most common experience every human being has, whether they're male or female, rich or poor, whatever race, nationality, ancient India or modern Switzerland, suffering is the common, ordinary, banal experience of humanity. And then the Buddha called that the First Noble Truth. Now that's a unique approach in terms of religion, what we call religion. Because it's not a belief, you know, it's not asking, the Buddha wasn't telling you to believe in the First Noble Truth. All you have to do is look at it, feel it, feel the suffering, feel the worry about the future, or the regret about the past, or the sense of being separate and isolated, loneliness, all the angst and anxiety of our human condition is a noble truth. So this is a changing from seeing that suffering is something we want to get rid of, we're trying to find permanent happiness. So we reject suffering, we seek distraction from discomfort, suffering, physical pain, disease, anxiety, psychological problems. We're seeking other alternatives in order to find happiness or stability or confidence. But the Buddha said, understand suffering. So the First Noble Truth of suffering is not a metaphysical truth. It's not ultimate truth. But it is a condition. It is a sankhara. It's a condition. It's a phenomenon that we can observe here and now, wherever we are. And then the Buddha said to understand suffering. To understand something, you have to accept it, rather than just react to it by trying to get rid of it, blame it on somebody else. To understand suffering, then, is to observe it. Suffering is something you can witness to. Conscious awareness, mindfulness of suffering is like this. This sense of loneliness or fear of the future, anxiety, worry, regret, guilt. You observe that. That which observes suffering isn't suffering. You know, usually we don't, we identify with the suffering. It's my suffering. We believe it's mine and we've got to get rid of it, it's bad. But we aren't mindful, we just take for granted that when we feel anxiety, worry, fear, desire, it's personal. But that which is aware, like consciousness, awareness, is not personal. It's universal. So when we're aware, we have perspective on the suffering or the mental state, the emotional state, the physical condition that we're experiencing here and now. So then there's Four Noble Truths. The first one established on the banal and ordinary human experience of suffering. Then there's the second one is the origin. Suffering is not permanent. It's not ultimate reality. It's a condition that arises and ceases according to other conditions. So we begin to be aware of like desire. Now to reflect on this experience, the human bodies that we're experiencing here now are desire forms. You know, so they're sexual forms, they're desire forms. What we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, and feel is we desire the pleasant and we desire to get rid of the unpleasant. So the sense world, the objects of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thinking itself is created out of desire. And so we become aware of desire. Now the self-view, the ego, says we are our desires. You know, that's what we believe, that desire, whatever form it takes, is personal. It's mine, rather than trusting in the awareness of desire, which isn't desire. Consciousness is not desire. Consciousness is not limited to desires. So you're aware of sensual desire, desire for sense pleasures, desire for attaining and becoming something else. You feel that you're lacking something, you want to get something, you want to get enlightenment, you want to go to heaven or whatever kind of aspirations. To get something that you feel you don't have is a form of desire. And the desire to get rid of anger or greed or fear is another form of desire. But what is it that's aware of desire is not desire. So awareness, mindfulness, is not desiring anything. It brings perspective on desire, on sensual desire, aspirations, desire for becoming, or desire to get rid of something you have that you don't like, you don't want. So this is the origin or the cause of suffering as a beginning. In the Second Noble Truth, we're told to investigate these desires, not analyze them. In this way, investigation is not analytical. It's not figuring out why you have fear, or why you have anger, or why you have jealousy, or why you have greed. It's not to figure out why, but to observe that greed is like this, anger is resistance, aversion is like this, mental confusion is like this. You're aware when you're confused, when there's too many ideas coming, too many demands made on you, is like this. When life becomes too difficult, too unbearable, then you know it's like this. But if you aren't reflective, if you aren't aware, if you aren't mindful of what you're feeling, then you tend to try to get rid of it, blame it on somebody else, on some other condition. So this is the way of wisdom or investigation. It's not personal, it's not creating a sense of separate self, but trusting in that which is common to all of us, conscious awareness, pure presence here and now. And of course this applies to when you're here at Dhammapala, or you go home, you're traveling, between here and there, when you go abroad, or wherever, whether you're sitting, standing, walking, lying down, whether you're breathing in and out. There's awareness, conscious presence, conscious awareness is our refuge. So through investigating, like these Four Noble Truths are for investigation. They're not doctrinal positions to take on life or yourself. And they're skillful means the Buddha used after his enlightenment. Because what we call enlightenment doesn't have any language. There's no language that you can use to get enlightened. You know, so languages themselves are sankharas, so they have their limitations. So whether it's Pali language, Sanskrit language, French, German, English, Thai, they're all sankharas. So when the Buddha was enlightened, it wasn't through language or through thought, but through insight, through understanding. Now how do you explain that? How do you teach that to somebody else? And how can you make that which is has no quality, no condition that you can give to somebody else. So his insight was to teach the First Noble Truth, the most common human experience, suffering. And by changing your attitude to suffering, from trying to escape it, get rid of it, to understanding it, through the second, third, fourth Noble Truths. So the second Noble Truth is recognizing the origin. Suffering is not permanent, it's not personal. It seems personal. It has this personal quality that we, you know, emotionally we feel very aligned with our suffering. We feel it's definitely me, my emotions. What I feel, love, hate, anger, resistance, seems very, very personal. Definitely me. But on further investigation, reflection, we begin to see that when this sense of me and mine arises, it's a word. You keep identifying, you say, this is my suffering. This is mine, this is me. When you stop thinking, when you let go of thought as an identity, there's suffering. And through reflecting on it, accepting it, understanding it, you see suffering is impermanent, it ceases. And when you let suffering cease, it's not you're trying to get rid of it, you're just letting it do its natural thing, is to, if it arises, it ceases. You're also aware of non-suffering, which is the third noble truth. Mindfulness allows suffering to exist, to cease, and when there's no grasping of conditions, no identifying with conditioned phenomena, when there's been relinquishment, letting go of suffering, not annihilation of it, it's not a rejection, letting go of it, what remains when you let go of everything is non-suffering. So this is for investigation, like vipassana. The word vipassana is insight. It's to develop this, to know this for yourself. Something, you can be interested in, or you can believe or disbelieve in Buddhist teaching, whatever, you're so inclined to do. Doubt it. When I first started, I became interested in Buddhism long before I became a monk. But I didn't know whether it had any value or not in my life. It's just an interesting religious philosophy from Asia. And so that was the initial interest. I read some books on Zen Buddhism and they interested me. So that I call the arising of faith, saddha in Pali, because suddenly something that I didn't know anything about, that I knew nothing about before, reading a book on Zen Buddhism interested me. But I still had doubts about it, is it just, I was brought up as a Christian, I studied different religions, I was interested in philosophy and psychology, all these kind of intellectual interests. But, no matter how much you read about philosophy or metaphysics or psychology, you still suffered. Because you hadn't got to the root, to the root of the problem. You were merely analyzing, figuring out from the personal level why I feel like this, why I think like this, why I react like this. So then that interest, initial interest, brought me to this point, like here today. 60 years later. And so during my lifetime, I've had the, incredible opportunity to practice with this teaching of the Buddha, made available like in Thailand, with Ajahn Chah, Lungpho Cha, was always pointing at Dhamma. This is why I stayed with Lungpho Cha, was because of the way he taught. He wasn't pointing at himself as, I'm an enlightened master and you believe what I say and obey me. He was always, his whole way of kind of directing our attention was to observe the state of mind. The first year when I became a bhikkhu and went to live with Lungpho Cha, I couldn't understand Thai. For the first month that I was there at Wat Bapong, there were two Thai monks who could translate English and Thai. But they left. And I was there with a tape recorder and a book called Fundamentals of the Thai Language, which was all about Thai in Bangkok, but all I was hearing was Isan Thai. That's all I heard was a Northeast dialect, which is very different. So, it's very confusing You know, what do, as many of you are aware, living in a culture whose language you don't understand, whose ways are totally different. You know, Thai culture, especially at that time, 1967, in northeast Thailand, it was very kind of old-fashioned northeast Thai culture that I was living in, which was totally different than West Coast American. And coming from Christian background and educated in universities in America, ending up in Wattapong and Ua and Rajatani in northeast Thailand, you know, it was the mental states where it would arise, being confused or misunderstanding or wanting to leave or feeling I'm wasting my time, or, you know, there's so much frustration in trying to learn another language and adapt to a culture that's so totally different from what you're used to and what you've been assumed to be, you know, the way to live. But because I had this faith and trust in Dhamma and Lumpur Cha, and I had this trust with Ajahn Chah and the way he taught. He was not trying to convert me or tell me what to do, but to point the directions. So he advised me always to observe the state of mind I was having, to see, be the one that knows the state of mind rather than becoming the owner, becoming that state of mind itself. So there's a difference, isn't there? There's, you know, the state of mind is like this. You feel confused. You want to go back to America, is like this. That's a state of mind that comes and goes. That's not permanent, Ajahn Sumedho. That comes according to conditions. But what is it that knows the conditions, the presence and absence of conditions? And so in the Thai forest tradition, northeast Thailand Thai forest tradition, the Ajahns tend to teach this mantra, Puto, which is the Buddha's name, which means to know. It means knowing here and now. Awareness, in other words. And since it's not analytical, it's not, you can't describe it. It's not, you know, you can't describe frustration. You have a word, frustration, but the reality of frustration is like this. The word frustration doesn't have any feelings. You know, it's just a word that comes into your mind and leaves. But the reality of being frustrated is like this. And the knowing of frustration. Because before I met Ajahn Chah, I was identifying, I'm frustrated, I want something different, I don't think I fit in here, this isn't what I came for. All these doubts, self-views generated from this frustration. But Ajahn Chah keeps saying to know frustration is a sankhara. So you change your attitude. You allow frustration, allow anger, allow worry, anxiety, all these negative mental states that nobody wants. You allow them, you're aware of them, you're not analyzing them. You're not, because the analysis makes them very personal. Like anger, for example. If you try to figure out why you get angry, you get very, very personal. Because anger seems very much like a personal personality that we are clinging to. But in mindfulness, sati sampajanya, these are the Pali words for mindfulness, is to know frustration, anger is like this. and being patient with it, you're allowing it to be there. You don't act on it, you just don't speak on it. In monasticism, we have this Vinaya discipline about action and speech. So we are mindful not to act or speak on what we're feeling. If it's negative, if it's going to cause disruption and harm or offend or create problems, we don't act physically or speak on it, but we're aware of it. And as we're aware of it, we accept it. And then it ceases. So I remember when I had the first insight into the absence of anger. Because before I was always trying to get rid of anger, suppressing it usually, trying to deny it, seeing it as some kind of personal flaw, and in following the instructions of the Buddha in the Second Noble Truth, to know anger is like this. Only I was willing to be angry, but observing it and in the actual reality of the feeling of anger, not analyzing it or figuring out, trying to describe it, but recognizing it. Because that which recognizes anger isn't angry. Mindfulness never gets angry or greedy or worried or frightened. So that's our refuge in terms of, the tradition, Theravada Buddhism, we take refuges in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. What does that mean anyway when we chant Bhutang Saranam Gacchami, Dhammang Saranam Gacchami, Sangkang Saranam Gacchami? What do we mean? It's a ceremony, it's Pali language, it's from an ancient Indian language called Pali. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dhamma, I take refuge in Sangha. What does that really mean? Is it just ceremonial custom, or has it much more profound meaning than just ceremony? Is it, that's the surface. But the actual importance of refuge is awareness. That's your refuge. Always here and now, whether you're sitting, standing, walking, lying down, whether you're happy or unhappy. So then people ask, what happens when you let go of everything? It can sound like you're just in a state of blank, kind of zombie-like vacuum. Well, this you have to find the absence of non-grasping, non-fear, non-desire, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, is still conscious. And consciousness is peaceful. So that this is what you recognize in monks like Lumphuan Cha, they're peaceful. Even though he had a very nice personality, he was charming as a person, he had charisma, but we're not trying to become Ajahn Chah. What is his always his relentless pointing was at the jitta, at the here and now, the state of mind, the emotional quality that you're experiencing here and now. To see also, it's very important to change your attitude about your physical body, seeing it always in personal ways, as male or female, as young or old. We're identified so strongly with the physical forms that we're experiencing. There's always these conflicts arising about what I am and you are. If I see myself only as a physical form, then I see the rest of you all as physical forms. separate from myself, which could, you know, when you praise me, I'm happy. When you condemn me, I get angry. I'm necessarily reacting to praise and blame. I'm successful, I'm a winner, I'm a champion, I feel happy, I'm a failure, lost the plot. Success and failure are worldly dhammas. But knowing, awareness, isn't about success or failure, praise or blame. It's always your refuge, safe. A refuge is the safety of awareness that is available to us all the time. And it's learning to trust this awareness. So when people keep asking what I'm teaching, I'm usually encouraging you to trust your awareness, mindfulness. And it's non-critical. So if you're feeling angry or confused or jealous or frightened, awareness doesn't judge it. It doesn't say you shouldn't feel this way. You create this out of the not taking refuge in awareness. You create refuge in your a judgmental thinking mind. As I shouldn't feel this way, this is bad. I'm a bad person for having these emotions. You create that through thinking and believing your thoughts. But if you take refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha or awareness itself, it's non-judgmental. It's non-critical. The thinking mind is a critical function. So when a baby is born, it doesn't think. It's conscious in a human form, but a baby's mind doesn't have an ego. It doesn't see itself as a baby, as a male or a female baby, as a Swiss or a Thai. It gets this information later on. So all that is acquired knowledge, language is acquired after birth. It's not from consciousness. You're not born with a thought process. It's acquired learning after birth that's identifying and judging. The thinking mind is about big and small, good and bad, right and wrong, heaven and hell. When you think, if you think heaven, you've got to have hell along with it. Good and bad as its opposite. But awareness isn't about good and bad, right and wrong, heaven and hell. It's here and now, it's peaceful. It isn't about presence and absence, because it's always present. It's just learning to trust it. Trust this awareness. So at this point I'll stop, and if there are any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Question about experiencing the awareness. And I was a long time ago, I was working with the sound of silence, and I'm curious what you would tell today about this. For me, it was always kind of an access when I mean there are no words for awareness, but this
did you find it useful?
Split, you know. Yeah, I find it useful, and I'm really grateful because it accompanies me till now, so it's...
Yeah, well, it's... it's not really a sound.
I know.
Because sounds are beginnings and endings. But I didn't know what it was myself when I became aware of it. it's like a vibration or whatever. Whatever word isn't really necessary as long as you recognize it. And when you notice it, you stop thinking. And you can even notice it while you're thinking. This is what I found, that you know, I had insight before I met Lungpa Cha, before I met him. I was a samanera, a novice monk, for a year at another monastery. And I spent a year meditating on the Four Noble Truths. And I began to notice that when you're alone by yourself in a kuti for a year, you know, nobody is in a place where nobody could speak English, strange things happen. So I really began to notice that after the turmoil of being alone and having lived a life before that of continuous distraction, as an avid reader, even if I went anywhere, I had to have a book with me. I had to read, distract myself through reading. This was before computers and iPads and things like that. So, I lived in this little hut, and they bring me food every day, and the first 3 months were pretty awful because you're lonely, you're restless, all kinds of negative mental states arise, you feel you're wasting your time, you start getting paranoid, you know, and fear of the dark and things like this. But if you're patient with that, they all cease. And I noticed when everything ceased, there was a sound of silence. And I made this koan up, like in Soto Zen, or one of those schools of Zen, I don't know which. They have koans, you know, conundrums that don't make sense. So what was your original face before you were born? And then the student has to go and solve this puzzle, you know, what is my face before I was born, and then try to think about it. And then, your thought process it's not reasonable, it doesn't make sense. And then you realize that when you ask yourself a question, you experience silence. Ask yourself anything, where are my car keys right now? And there's a gap there, there's a stillness. And you can be aware of the silence, sound of silence. And so I began taking interest in this. And then when I ordained as a bhikkhu, I went to stay with Lungpa Cha in Ubon. And he was always teaching from the Four Noble Truths. I never told him about my experience of sound of silence. I didn't, you know, the koan was, if everything is impermanent, all conditions are impermanent, is there something permanent? As my koan. And of course, I took tremendous faith in the Buddhist teachings that everything's impermanent. Sape, Sankara, Nicha, all conditions are impermanent. So I just believed that all conditions are impermanent. But then I began to realize the sound of silence is permanent. I mean, my attention to it comes and goes. Whether I'm aware of it or not is impermanent. But it's always here and now. I notice it right now talking to you. So then that interested me, because I realized that just trying to, you know, like trying to solve a koan through thinking, through the intellect, doesn't work. You come out with don't know. What's your original face before you're born? Don't know. You can't know that from the ego level. The ego was something you developed after you were born. So before you were born, if you try to use language and thought to try to figure out what was your original face before you were born, you just said, no, this nonsense, it doesn't make any sense. But in that questioning state, don't know state, there's a sound of silence. So I began to use that, and especially I found that when I went to live in London, the English Sangha Trust was a Buddhist organization that invited me and Lumpo Cha to London in 1977. So, you know, and I lived in the townhouse in Hampstead for 2 years. And the English Sangha Trust there was a tremendous internal conflict between the trustees. And so I was warned about this before I accepted the invitation, but I didn't give it great importance. But when you're actually in a situation where all this acrimonious conflict is going on, you know, and it affects you, you feel, I want to go back to Thailand. And before Lumpo Cha, he came, we went together in 1977 to London. And before he returned to Thailand, he made me promise I wouldn't go back to Thailand for 5 years. It was very wise of him. Because I would have gone back to Thailand the first year. And because what do you do? You know, here, both strong views, you know, and I found emotionally conflict, because I could agree with one and I could agree with the other. You know, I could see both sides. And, you know, I did have personal preferences, which side, but and then everybody was looking at me as the one to solve the problem. So I, you know, I just felt this incredible despair and confusion. And one afternoon I was walking down Haverstock Hill, which the Vihara was on this busy street in northeast London, and the sound of silence in a busy street, noisy street in London, the sound of silence attacked me. It suddenly became so strong in the midst of, you know, it wasn't a peaceful environment, but suddenly I remembered, I'd kind of forgotten it, living in Thailand. I didn't use it very much there. But in London, I found it incredibly helpful. It gave me perspective on the present moment. Because with empty, it's like the empty consciousness. It's like it's here and now, it's non-judgmental, it's taking in everything. So I could hear the one side, the other side, I could feel my own emotional feelings of liking or agreeing or disagreeing, horizon sees, all at the same moment. You know, it's a state where you're open, which includes everything, including your own emotional reaction, as well as hearing what people are talking about. So I use that in these meetings, acrimonious meetings, sound of silence, and instead of just getting, you know, wishing I weren't there and wanting to leave, to just this state of silence, in which I began to kind of an insight on what decision to make. So that, and then in my life in England, for example, being the head of a monastic community, you have, you know, you're putting yourself in a particular situation where everybody's looking at you all the time and listening, and they like or don't like you, and, you know, so you're kind of, you feel this sense of vulnerability because you're standing out and you look to, you know, people projecting all kinds of qualities onto you, and you're aware of that. How do you do that for the ego? You know, just become a tyrant, or just get totally confused, you know, obey me, or my way, or the highway, or is it an opportunity to develop this embracing silence, in which you know, to trust that, rather than your own personal reactions in the present moment, which could be anything. So, you know, and I found that gave me, you know, that cultivating that while being in that position. It was 5 years at Chithurst, and then we established Amaravati, over 34 pansas, 34 years in England as head of a monastic community. And then I also reflected that whether I succeeded or failed didn't matter, because the ego wants to succeed. I want to be approved of. I want to be liked as a person. I want to spread Buddhism in Europe. You know, I have all kinds of personal desires that are very altruistic. And then people were saying, Ajahn Sumedho is a missionary, Buddhist missionary in the UK. And you know, you've given titles, I've been given titles, high-minded titles and everything. So you're kind of, you know, if you're not mindful, how do you react to praise, to being given titles by the king or things like that? The ego likes that. But then when somebody doesn't like you and thinks you're rubbish and what you're teaching is wrong and not Buddha Dhamma and you don't know what you're talking about, or, you know, the blame, then what happens? Then the personality is, I'm wasting my life, I'm no good, I can't do this. Or you just want to lash back at people, tell them they're wrong and they, you know, that they're stupid, like Donald Trump does. You're crazy. So, you know, those are the two extremes, you know, being joyful and happy when you're getting accolades, and miserable and angry and offended and depressed when you're being criticized and blamed. Those two extremes, praise and blame, where with sound of silence or emptiness, there's no, you know, you're aware of praise when you're being praised, you're aware. It doesn't that I don't feel happy when people tell me how good I am, but I'm aware of that as a condition, not as a personal identity. Or when being criticized, the same thing. Again, where feeling offended or angry at what they're saying is like this. But this gives you perspective to not grasp these emotions. Like the third noble truth is about non-grasping. The second noble truth is about letting go of this ignorant attachment to conditions. Third noble truth is non-grasping. Because even, you know, I lived with Lumpur Chow for 10 years in Ubon, and as wise and as much loved as he was, he's also criticized. So I could see, you know, somebody who I was sure was an arahant, you know, and then other monks are criticizing them. And high-ranking monks, you know, like the head monk of the province hated Lumbo Chao. So this is, you know, but Lumbo Chao's attitude was always responding in appropriate ways to praise and blame rather than promoting himself or feeling angry at somebody who's criticizing. So it was one kind of a living example of this. I don't know whether Lumbo Chao ever noticed sound of silence. But I encourage you to trust it. Because notice that it's a way of stopping thinking. And at first I found that I couldn't sustain much. First I tried to concentrate on the sound of silence like it was an object. So I found out I could only sustain awareness around it, and then the mind would wander away. So, like, then I learned to just use the count of five. I count one, two, three, four. I listen to the sound of silence, just develop it for five counts. And more, just by giving more attention to it, it's more or less like mindfulness of it rather than concentrating on it. Don't concentrate on it because it doesn't work, because it's not a condition. It's not an object. It's here and now. So you begin to notice it. And it's more like a surrendering to it, relaxing with it, trusting it, and reflecting, non-thinking. Like think, but think in skillful ways, like non-thinking is like this. And you feel this sense of peace and calm. And then something happens, the sense of yourself arises or doubt arises. Is this really, am I right? Am I deluding myself? Because as a personality, my ego is a skeptical one. So it doesn't believe and trust in anything about myself that easily. So then I think Buddha never talks out of silence, so it's probably wrong. Or maybe it's some quirky thing in like a hearing problem, tinnitus or something. You know, I contemplated it as tinnitus or, but then after years of developing it, I started teaching it in England because I found out it works. I taught other monks. I told other monks about nuns about it to experiment with it. So in the Thai, they have the word jitwang, or the empty consciousness, non-grasping and consciousness. That's what it is. You're fully conscious, but you're not attached to a condition. It's like this. So it's referred to as unattached consciousness in the scriptures. And so then it says, since it doesn't begin and end, it doesn't die. So then you realize all that dies really is a body. If you're identified with your physical body, then you feel you're going to die. Because this is your reality, is what your physical condition. But if you trust in awareness, mindfulness, that doesn't die. Try to figure that out. And you can't with thought. It doesn't make sense. It's learning to trust awareness that you find liberation. Because thinking also is about birth and death. Every word is beginning and ending. You know, just like playing with my mind when I'm sitting up in my room, I'm looking out and they had all these cows chewing grass. And right outside the window. So I just sat and meditated, kind of just reflecting on that, just in a state of awareness. Because cows are quite peaceful creatures to contemplate. And then I played with my mind. I said, I pointed at one and I said, "You're a cow." That's a creation, isn't it? The cow doesn't see itself as a cow. I'm telling it what it is. And that's the convention. That's conventional reality only. You know, that's sankhara. But then you're a cow, the words come and go. What's left when I'm not thinking is awareness. Cows are still perceived, but they're not. There's no judgment or labeling or making any comments about them. Just the natural state of being aware is peaceful and contentment, like a cow. I like when people ask me about sound of silence. I did mention it when to Rinpoche. He came twice to London, to the UK, in 1977 was the first time, and then he came back in 1979. And he, in 1979, we moved to Chithurst from Hampstead, Chithurst in West Sussex. And so then when he was going to return to Thailand, somebody gave us their flat in London. So another monk and I spent the night with Lumpa Cha in his flat in London, and I asked Lumpa about sound of silence, and he didn't disagree with me. He didn't say anything either. So what is silence? You know, it doesn't have a sound, but it is knowing. So then people say, when I'm asleep, I'm not conscious. So what happens to consciousness when you fall asleep? And when I'm asleep, I don't notice sound of silence. And of course, you know, the senses aren't functioning when you're asleep, in deep sleep. So consciousness, you know, that we experience consciousness as it is implied in the five khandhas, the five, the body, the feelings, the memories, the emotions, the sense consciousness is all impermanent. So sense consciousness arises and ceases. You know, so you look at something and you're conscious of the microphone. You know, that's consciousness going out to an object. When you're asleep, you're not going out to objects. But you can also train yourself, you know, to wake up at a certain time without an alarm and things like this. The consciousness is just not active, not going out to anything when you're in deep sleep. But consciousness doesn't die. And you don't die when you're asleep. You're not going out to sense objects or thoughts. And then when you dream, it's imagery that you're creating, you know, but it's just conditions changing. It's not, you know, so there's a conscious level of awareness in a dream. Because when you're awake from the dream, you're aware it's just, you know, a memory. And then there's waking consciousness, which we're experiencing now. So we know we're awake, we're our eyes are open and we're listening. But the waking consciousness is what the Buddha used for realizing deathless reality, Dhamma, or the deathless consciousness, which is universal, not individual. It takes a while. That's why, like, everything I'm saying is for reflection, not for belief. You know, it's not a, I'm not trying to indoctrinate you or convert you, but to point to something, you know, that to encourage you to investigate your life. Don't believe what your thoughts tell you, your memories. You know, they're called empty phenomena, like the memory yesterday. It arises and ceases. It has no soul, no heart to it. It's just an empty condition that comes and goes according to other conditions. So you, by this continuous, like samatha meditation, there's samatha and vipassana. Samatha is going out to an object through the senses. So you get concentrated on an object, but you have to shut everything else out. You know, so you need to be alone in a quiet place and concentrate on an object of some sort, whether it's the breath or a candle flame or Buddha Rupa or whatever. And in order to get the samadhi through that kind of concentration, you have to set yourself up. The conditions have to be right for that kind of peaceful tranquility. And when the conditions change, then it's gone. So I found when I was doing summertime meditation, I'd get very selfish. Because I didn't, you know, anything that disturbed me, angered me. So it was like, you know, I want the world to shut up because I'm trying to get my samadhi together. So, like in where we live in Ratanawan, Wat Pa Ratanawan in Korat, Namwang Namkeo, It's a very nice place, very peaceful. But there's this peacock that hangs out around my kuti. And peacocks, as beautiful as they are, have the ugliest cry you've ever heard. So in open awareness, it's all right. There's no aversion. But if I start getting into concentration practices, then that peacock, then I ask Ajahn Asoka to get rid of it. Well, you're aware, this is not the path to get rid of peacocks, because they're... Well, no, I don't ask them to kill it, just chase it away, make it go somewhere and disturb some other one. Any other questions?
I have one question. So this is about my daughter. When she gets stuck and very quiet, and she starts really scared, and especially in the night. And I wonder if there are any way that I can help her.
Her daughter, when it gets very quiet, especially at night, when it's very quiet, she gets quite scared. And her mother's asking, is there any way she can help her?
Well, fear is, if, as long as you react to fear, then fear gets power over you. So, when you're afraid of ghosts or of darkness or that, then you believe in that, and then that kind of belief system takes you over. You're afraid, and you try to go into the light or listen to the radio or whatever. But in terms of mindfulness, fear is a condition. As you face it, as you observe it, fear is like this. You can observe the emotion of fear. And then it loses its power. It's like one of those Chinese dragons, paper dragons. It's just full of hot air. It looks frightening, but if you face it, it's totally harmless. And then fear is a primal emotion for the species. Like, there's a lot to be afraid of as a physical person, as a human individual, because we're easily damaged. We've got, we're not that strong, and we aren't that fast in running, or we don't have tough hides like rhinoceroses, or. We're pretty delicate creatures, and around out there there's trees falling, earthquakes, fires, droughts, starvation. There's so much to fear in terms of the conditioned realm. But in terms of meditation, the awareness is not afraid, and so it can observe fear. And your refuge is in the awareness. So, if take refuge, affirm your refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha or in Dhamma, that's your refuge, that's fearless, there's nothing to fear. And then fear becomes just an emotion that comes and goes according to conditions. So in as a novice monk in Thailand. You know, you're living alone in a forest. And I watched that fear of the dark. And, you know, so I always wanted a candle or a light on or something. There's no electricity. It was a very poor monastery, so they didn't even have many candles. So I observed the darkness. And as I opened to darkness, I realized that awareness isn't dark, it's light. Like consciousness isn't dark. So that your refuge is in awareness, because that's the gate to the deathless, the door to the deathless is awareness. Mindfulness is to be aware of, is it opens this door to infinite consciousness. So we're not just limited by sensory consciousness, sensory habits, emotional reactions to conditions. And so I thought, you know, taking refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha, if you're Buddhist, or in Dhamma, or in truth, you know, whether, or in Jesus Christ, if you're a Christian, all this will give you a sense of safety, you know, as a belief system. It's also valuable. But in terms of investigating reality, the awareness is fearless. Like your sexual desire and aversion and fear, they're primal emotions, primal energies to this sense realm. Like we've got animal bodies, just like monkeys and chimpanzees and dogs and cats. So we have the same, you know, where the bodies are for creating, procreating the species. And aversion or fear and resistance is a kind of self-protecting emotion. It's primal. It's for self-preservation. So they come with the birth of the physical body. You know, that's part of the package of having a human body, is that those are primal emotions. But because we're thinking like human beings think, we create ideas and positions. So we identify with sexual desires, with aversion and anger, with fear. It becomes personal. We create that. Where the, you know, in the insight into the path, you have this insight into, you know, that all conditions are impermanent and all Dhamma is not self. So that's like what they call stream entry. You realize you're not the physical body. But then the second stage is you still have sexual desires and aversion and fear, because that's, but it's not seen in personal terms anymore. Like right now, modern societies identify with their sexual orientation, with their gender. Everybody, you know, are you transgender, are you man, woman, are you both male and female? These are all creations out of thinking. The body is, you know, bodies are male or female, we give them the labels. But nowadays everybody's got to be identified with their sexual identity, you know, what they feel they are sexually. And that's a creation of the human mind. That's not Dhamma, that's not the reality of the moment, but it is a convention that is people, you know, create a lot of suffering over these identities. And then, for example, being a Buddhist monk, you've got an ideal of being a, you know, you should have loving kindness, you should be compassionate. You know, the ideal of a bhikkhu, you know, you want to get rid of your defilements. You know, in Thai they say, ka kile, kill your kilesas. And so, you know, this appeals to the ego a lot. You know, I want to get rid of, annihilate anger. I want to be a loving kindness kind of monk, forgiving, all embracing, compassion is an ideal for a Buddhist monk. And then, no matter how beautiful the ideal is, that's not the way you actually feel half the time. Because monastic life can be really irritating and frustrating. It's the convention. So then you think, you feel guilty. You create guilt about the fact that you don't like another monk. You want to strangle him. That's a disrobing offense. But if you're mindful, then, you know, like this was, it's quite, because being American, from an American background, you're very idealistic. American culture is about ideals, about freedom, democracy, equality, all the very best. And so you're brought up with this idealism, and you're thinking in terms of how things should be. So you end up being critical of everything. You're critical of yourself, you're critical of the government, you're critical of your parents, you're critical of your teachers, it just goes out into, because then nobody is perfect in the sense of an ideal. An ideal doesn't feel anything, like your bodies are not ideal forms. Like you can have marble statues that are the human form, male or female, that are ideal forms. But they don't feel anything. They don't have to live with nerve endings and eyes that see and noses that smell anything. So an ideal is you know, it's beautiful, but it doesn't feel. It's not sensitive. We're in this state of sensitivity. It's like this. I mean, a human form. This human form is a totally sensitive condition. It's not marble. It's not brass. It's flesh and blood, nerve endings, and it has to be fed. The body is nothing but food. We have to eat food to keep the body alive. So all these bodies are just food. And so, you know, to see yourself as food is interesting. Because, you know, a lion comes along and sees you as food. And you are, you know, you could end up in the stomach of a lion. And defecated out in a jungle. And that's, you know, so why do you want to identify with food all the time? That is a way of reflecting. Where we take it all, you know, I am this, you know, what we look like, whether we're attractive or unattractive, whether we're dark or light, whether we're male or female, young or old, all these are creations out of the ignorant human mind. They're conventions. They're not, I'm not saying we got to get rid of them. It's not annihilation. But it's changing your attitude from believing in conditioned phenomena as self to recognizing it's not self. It is it is what it is, but it's condition changing rather than some kind of personal identity. So like in Vipassana meditation, it's this embracing awareness, like Samatha's focused on an object, the openness of Vipassana isn't focused on an object, it's aware of the way things are. So you've got four foundations of mindfulness, and these are like reflections on the body, on the feelings, on state of mind, on Dhamma. But the samadhi of open consciousness is sama samadhi, perfect samadhi. It's aware, accepting everything. It's like this, an awareness of the arising, ceasing of conditions of what we through sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thought, feeling, emotion. And the more you trust in this kind of reflective ability, the awareness becomes stronger and connected. You know, at first you're aware and then you forget it, you get carried away with a thought or a feeling. But if you trust this awareness, eventually it's stronger than your thought patterns, your emotional habits, your physical identity. So it really, you know, it's in the Fourth Noble Truth is samadhiti, perfect. I translate samadhiti as perfect understanding. There's a knowing that is no longer based on thinking, so it's no longer doubting. It's jnana, what they call jnana dasana, or insight knowledge. So when I say the way it is, it's not, you know, some people misunderstand me when I say your feeling of anger arises, that's the way it is. It's not a resignation to, a passive resignation to the state. It's not, no, that's the way it is, so what, you know, who cares? It's not that kind of way it is. It's an affirmation of the right now can only be like this. At this moment, you can only feel like you're feeling, whether you like it or not. You know, but at this like this, you're feeling like this. So you don't need to explain to me exactly what you're feeling, but knowing that it's like this. So with Thumpa Cha, you know, as I began to see, he accepted life as he experienced it. When the praise came, when the blame came, when the monks ordained, when the monks disrobed, when there were internal problems and external problems. You know, Lumpo Cha always had this sense of the way it is, didn't seem to change, where you know, until I recognized the value of that, then I'd get upset or happy according to the condition. When life in the monastery was going the way I wanted it, I was happy. When it changed, I was unhappy. When we ordained new people, I was happy. When I disrobed them, I was unhappy. And so you're a kind of helpless victim of the circumstances that are a part of the changing samsara, the conditions that of the physical body, of the emotional world, the external world, the internal feelings and identities. You really want to be caught in that vicious pattern of birth and death? Or is there a way to liberate yourself from birth and death? And that's what the whole point of these Four Noble Truths is the directional signs. They're not dogmas, they're doctrines. It's like if you want to go to Bern, you go out on the highway and you see a sign saying B-E-R-N, and Bern, it says so. But it's pointing at something, isn't it? Pointing the direction to go. So, you know, and the Noble Truth aren't pointing that suffering is what you are, but they're directions to observe, to go in that direction, rather than believing in just Four Noble Truths because they're Buddhist.
Kalayang damawa dakata sadu karang dhamma se
sadu 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 anumodam.
Are you okay? You want to receive a few people? So if anyone wants to come up and say hello.
Well,